Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth.
It's a safe place, okay? So there might be some judgment here from the people sitting next to you, but I have no judgment for you. How many of you guys enjoy a little bit of reality TV from time to time? Like just a little bit? Yeah. I love reality TV, the game shows, like Survivor and Big Brother. Ooh, that's a good one. That one gets me every single time. Because they just have cameras everywhere and people are just, their humanity is on full display, right? And if you watched Survivor, you know that the only way to be sure to lose in Survivor is to tell the truth. If you are an honest person, you are chum for the whales in that show. You are just going to get eaten alive. And so in watching these shows and watching all these, I don't know if had anyone ever known someone who's been on a reality TV show like that, like a game show competition? Loosely? Oh, that's good. All right, we need to talk more. Okay, all right. I was having a conversation with a friend about what would your strategy be if you went into one of these shows. And one of the reasons why I thought, like, I could never be on these shows, and by the way, this all comes after because I wouldn't want to be separated from my wife and kids for months and months on end, but the other reason is that as a pastor, there is no way that's going well for me on a show, right? Like, there's just absolutely no framework where being a pastor on a reality TV show is going to work. And I had a friend argue with me about this. He said, I would go on there, also a pastor, by the way, and I would lie and cheat and steal. Like, I have studied this game. I know how to play it well. And then, with the money you win, you could do incredible things with it, right? Give money to Oxfam and World Relief. Like, you could help all kinds of people. And we had long conversations about, I don't think you can do that. Like, I don't think it's going to be worth the cost. Like, if you never want to be a pastor again, by all means, go all in. Say you're a pastor. And the thing that I love is if you watch these shows, there's a number of people that are just doing awful things to people, like lying and like, no, we're totally on a team together. Like, you and me all the way to the end, and then immediately selling them out. And they only get so many books, and a lot of times they'll have the Bible as a book, and just cherry-picking the Bible, unlike few other people. They're just like, yes, Lord, you will lay a feast before mine enemies. Like, I just love that verse when I'm on reality TV shows. The thing that I love about the reality TV show thought or concept and thinking about Christianity is for a lot of us, it's this kind of active conversation. What does it mean to be a Christian in the world? Like, how are you supposed to act? And what can you get away with as a Christian and still be considered a Christian to most people? Like, I've had numerous conversations, probably not with you, but somebody who's not here this morning, where they're like, I almost don't want the people that I work with to know I'm a Christian, right? I don't know that I want them to know that I go to church on Sunday because they might have all kinds of questions for me about what I do and how I behave. I myself, for a long time, are like, I'm not a good enough driver to have a Jesus fish on the back of my car. If I was more polite and considerate, sure. But until then, there's no way. We have this way of thinking about our faith and engaging Christianity and the way we live. A lot of times they don't always align. There's our beliefs. There's the things that we hold about the way human beings should engage and treat one another and the way that Jesus is inviting us to see our neighbor, to see people who have less than us, to see people who are in need, to stop, to care, to help, to engage. And then we have our to-do list. And then the rubber hits the road, and life gets kind of hectic and sideways, and we're at work, and we're like, no one's really looking, and I could do the Christian thing, or I could get stuff done, right? And we have this kind of push and pull. How much of the gospel do we allow to impact and transform our lives? This is the reason why we're looking at the third shortest book in all of the Bible. We're looking at Philemon. Philemon is, you'll blink and you'll miss it. It's just one chapter. It's this short letter, and we're going to talk today about why this letter. We're going to ask all the W questions. We're going to look at when. We're going to look at what. We're going to look at who. We're going to set the stage for the concept of this little letter. Because at the end of the day, I think what it's addressing is what you believe about the nature of Jesus, about the nature of faith, that there is one God, and what do you do with that? What does that have to say about your day-to-day life, your decisions, the way you merge, the way you shop, the way you treat your server at a restaurant, how you tip, how you do parenting, how you do everything? Does it actually connect? Does it matter? Does the Bible, this book that's written thousands of years, does it have something to say about our lives and what we do? So, here's what we're going to do today, and I'm going to preface this. We are going to do a deep dive into the history and the context of the book. One of my favorite biblical commentators and writers says, a text without a context is a pretext for making it say whatever you want. I'll say it again because it's good. A text, a book, something you read, without a context, when was it written, who wrote it, what were they writing about, is a pretext in the beginnings of making it say whatever you want. And oftentimes we do this with the Bible. We go through and we read, and I'll share my favorite one again. People love Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. And we're like, Jesus, yes. Plans to prosper me and not to bring on the accurate, Lord Jesus, yes. Make your face to shine upon me in my bank account, Lord. Jeremiah is written by a prophet who is speaking unmentionable doom over the Israelite nation. He was saying, you're all going to die because you've been awful for a really, really long time. There's a conquering nation that's going to come in and obliterate you. Okay, it's Jeremiah 29. That's like the first 28 chapters of that book is it's awful, it's bad, and these are all the ways. You haven't cared about the poor. You haven't cared about the orphans and widows around you. You haven't stewarded resources well, and this is why this doom is coming. And then he says, and yet, like 2% of you are going to survive. And for that 2%, for I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. If you don't know the context, you just think, oh, well, that's for everybody all the time. Not saying it's possible at times in this world and life, we're a part of the 98%. Maybe the first 28 chapters are what we should be reading and ingesting and looking at. This is why context matters. This isn't just a history lesson for the sake of history. This is setting the groundwork by which we understand what is, in this case, Paul, what is he writing about, what he's talking about, okay? We're going to dive deep into all this time 2,000 years ago because then it's going to provide all the rich texture to where we can understand it today, 2017. Sound good? Ooh, I love Bible stuff. So if you don't, you pick the wrong Sunday. Here we go. Let's look at when. So one of the fun things about this is if you get into the Bible and writing about the Bible, biblical scholars debate and fight about literally everything. Everything is up for debate. But the letter of Philemon is one of the few utterly unquestioned letters that they believe is written by Paul. Because oftentimes how it would work is you would have a leader, someone who had a name and authority, and other writers would write using their name because it lent authority to what they were writing. So there's debate. Sometimes they're like, did they write this? Did they not? Philemon is one of the few utterly unquestioned. There aren't any, I mean, there's always one Bible scholar, right? At some point in the last 2,000 years, like, oh, I'm not so sure. But this is the one where, like, we're sure he wrote it. He wrote it sometime between 59 and 61. Now, if you're familiar with the calendar and how it works, a lot of times when we say we have this delineation BC AD, and sometimes it's BCE or CE. So that's before Christ and then after death, BC AD, or before Common Era, Common Era. What gets a little confusing about that is the mark for it isn't when Jesus died, it isn't resurrection, but it's roughly about the time we believe that Jesus was born. So a letter written in 59 to 61, if Jesus lived for 30 years, started his ministry, died at about the age of 33, you can see we're within 30 years of the ascension of Jesus, which may seem like a very long time to you, but in the ancient world, this is lightning fast. This is really, really quick. The earliest writings in the Bible would have been written right around this time. So 59 to 61, written by Paul. At this time, Paul is in prison. Now, there's a couple of different imprisonments of Paul, and they're important to delineate. If you were here a number of weeks ago, we had Jonathan Martin with us, and he read a passage where Paul was in prison, in chains, and there was the earthquake, and he was freed. The jail cells popped open. This isn't that. 59 to 61, he was on house arrest, which means that Paul was living in a rented apartment. He just had a guard with him at all times to watch what he was doing and to say, what was it that they were watching? What were they doing? Why were they so interested in Paul? The idea of religion and belief about who God is was really, really important in the Roman world. And the reason why Christianity wasn't accepted on a broad basis at all, it was actually condemned and hunted and certainly imprisoned for people that were preaching this gospel, is because what the Roman Empire was interested was peace at all cost. They talk about the Pax Romana. So if you have this little sect within the whole Roman world of Jews, and another little sect comes out of that little sect, and they're like, hey, you know how we've been talking about the Messiah? He came, and it was that Jesus guy we all killed. This other little sect would say, no, that's not true at all. And they would lead to this fighting. And this little Christian group, they kept on using words like saying, we have the gospel of Jesus Christ. The first writers of the Bible, they didn't create gospel. Gospel or good news is what they would have assigned to the reign of every Caesar, every ruler of the Roman world that ever existed. What they were saying is, you've heard the good news of Caesar. I'm here to tell you the good news of Jesus. This was the equivalent of preaching anarchy. You would become an enemy of the state if you were out preaching this kind of message. It's so funny because today, at least I'll speak for myself, if you were to say like Christianity, I think of someone having a piece of white toast in Nebraska and reading their Bible, right? Like just praying and like a very consistent job and like just being very nice and kind to everyone. Where the roots of Christianity is one of the most radical and revolutionary things that existed. It was hunted and persecuted for a reason. And one of the things that gets missed, this is one of the primary questions in my youth in Christianity. I get Jesus, and like he's nice, and he has flowing hair and a white robe. I don't know, I kept it so white, but he's just awesome. Why did they kill him? Why did they put that guy on the cross? I thought he was just walking around like dropping peace signs and saying he loves everyone. Why did they kill him at this point in his ministry? Because it was revolutionary. Because what Jesus was talking about was flipping the whole system. So when we read this, you have to rediscover how revolutionary this is. If it's not revolutionary to you, I would say it's probably not the good news. It's probably not the gospel. It should shake things up because that's what the message of Jesus does, enough that they killed him for it. And Paul was in prison during this time. Here's the other big thing to note in just kind of the history of this world. So this is 5961. One of the big major dates for you to know and recognize is 70. 70 is a huge, huge date in Judaism and Christianity. It's the date that in Jerusalem, the temple, the Jewish temple, was destroyed. And there's just no way for us to properly understand how significant that would have been for all the Jews living in the Roman world. The temple would have been their church. It would have been their town center. It would have been their cultural center. It would have been their football stadium. It would have been their, think whatever town you grew up in, it would have been their Pioneer Courthouse Square. It would have been their center of commerce and downtown. It represented everything to the Jewish life of the people living in Jerusalem, but all over the land. In the story of Jesus, when he is crucified, he comes from his home up in Nazareth, up here by the Sea of Galilee, down to the Dead Sea where Jerusalem was. Because Jews from all over would come to Jerusalem, to that temple, for the high holy holidays, like Passover. In 70, it was destroyed. Why? Because Jews had this belief that they were the Lord's chosen people, and that God was going to reestablish them like it had happened in the past. And so they would lead these insurrections pretty regularly. There's a famous one that predates Jesus. It's the Maccabean Revolt, which was this big deal where this small group of people fought off the Roman centurions, and they actually won. They fought them all off, and then they called a little base, and they're like, they're pretty sure they're sending the troops. What they didn't know was there was huge turnover in power in Rome, and so they're like, eh, forget about it. For this little period of time, though, where they were like, we won. Like, we won. I think it would have been like the party scene in Star Wars in Endor. Like, there was dancing and cheering. They're like, we did it. And everyone was thinking that Joseph Maccabeus was the Messiah. This idea of Jesus as Messiah, as the chosen one to lead the Jewish people, there were other people that they thought, oh, this is it. There had been enough uprising, there had been enough unrest in the Jewish people that they said, then let's cut off the head. Cut off the head of the beast. They went right to the temple and they destroyed it. It would have been the apocalypse. It was the end of the world for the Jewish people and certainly for Jewish Christians. It wasn't like they stopped caring just because of Jesus. So here's why I say all that. 61 is really close to 70. There's a lot of turmoil. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of politics and talking and fear and wars and threats of wars, okay? Let's move on to the who. The who in this story is, we'll look at three main characters. One is Paul. If you're not familiar, Paul, he was an author. He was a missionary. He is responsible for spreading the Christianity, and we'll look at a map in a little bit, to most of this Roman Empire. He moved around in pretty amazing ways and would plant churches, get church started, and then he would write letters to them and he would encourage them. And he would also step in when there was church squabbles. A lot of times there'd be fights because it's this whole new thing is happening. It's this, hey, Jesus was the Messiah. So you had Jews that were becoming Christians, and then, and the thing that was blowing people's minds, you had Gentiles, which is the Jewish word for everyone who's not us. They were becoming Christians too. And so you had all these questions about, well, Jews had clear dietary laws. Gentiles didn't. Jews, for all their males, would recognize circumcision as a key religious act. Gentiles didn't. And so they were saying, wait, if we're all Christian now, like, what do we do? How do we do this? Paul was stepping in, and he was providing guidance to all these churches as they were meeting together. If you're not familiar with Paul's story, he was initially known as Saul. He was there at the stoning of Stephen, one of the earliest Christians, and he's known as the first Christian martyr. They killed him because of his proclamation of who Jesus was and the gospel. And Saul, who became Paul, he was there helping out in this. He was a Jew who was hunting out Christians to have them arrested, to have them detained. And he meets Jesus on the road to Damascus, and he has this incredible moment and experience that transforms him into being one of the foremost spreaders of the gospel. So he's the author. He's writing this to Philemon. He's the guy that we named the book at, right? Philemon, he is a wealthy business owner, and he's the host of a house church in Colossae. So if you're familiar, another key book, letter written, is Colossians. And it also kind of goes with the timing. The letter of Colossians and Philemon were written at the same time, and they were sent to Colossae together. One was going to be a public one, read in all the churches, the book of Colossians. Philemon was a private letter to Philemon. So Philemon, at some way, somehow, probably through relationship with Paul, we pick up from the letter, he becomes a Christian. And when you have a new kind of religion, a new thing happening, you don't have a lot of land ownership. You don't have a lot of money. They're not springing up churches and kind of new temples everywhere. Christianity in this age, 30 years after the ascension of Christ, this is a house church model. So what it means is that it's these small groups of people all over the city. All over is too much. They are around the city. There are pockets of them around. And they are having church gatherings where they would come together, they would pray, they would sing hymns, and they would also find out the financial needs of everyone in the room and make sure that everyone's financial needs were met, made sure that people had food. They would kind of take an offering to make sure that people were okay. So Philemon is wealthy enough to host this. Now, this is incredibly important because the Jesus message, because of the life of Jesus, was primarily, it was filled with people who didn't have a lot of resources, that didn't have a lot of money, because the message of Jesus Christ acknowledged them and allowed them to be full participants within the life and service of the church, to be a part of it. It was a revolution. And one of the things we're going to talk about, it even recognized slaves in worship. Slaves had an active role within the life and the worship of the church. They didn't have to like go sit in the slave section. Everyone was all together. It was actually revolutionary, also for the role of women, which in that society were not seen as equals. There's a great book called The Contra Celsum. It was written by this early church father named Origen. And he was looking at all the critiques that this guy Celsus wrote about the church. One of his key critiques is it's a weak-minded religion that is led and facilitated by women, which is also incredibly important in the early world because during this time, a male was necessary by law and tradition to carry on any property, any rights of family. They would have the inheritance. So infanticide of young girls was somewhat common to where numerically within their system, women were a minority group. We're used to 50-50 spread, but through different times in history, that has not been true at all. And in this world, women were a minority group who held less rights. So you have this awesome thing that's being, it has all this government pressures, people are attacking it. They have a voice and a role for all people, and it's operating within churches. Philemon is hosting one of these things. Isn't that awesome? A little bit? Five of you think that's super cool. That's great. Last one is Onesimus. Onesimus is a former slave of Philemon who had run away. He had become a friend of Paul, and he's really, in large part, a subject of this letter. He's what Paul is writing about. He's saying, hey, Philemon, I'm sending Onesimus back to you. And what does that mean? How does that function? How does that work? One thing that's really important to note, because in the way that Paul writes this, Paul is demonstrating a lot of tact. He's kind of using different language, and it's a very indirect way. He's not saying like, hey, Philemon, you need to do this stuff right now. Peace, I'm out. It's like a long letter. It's like, hey, I thank God every time I think of you, and you're awesome, and you found Christ. And guess what? Onesimus, he found Christ too. And he has this line in there where he said, maybe Onesimus wasn't useful to you before, but he will be useful to you now. And you're like, you're talking about a human being like he's a claw hammer. Like, that's weird. Why are you doing that? It's a joke. He's writing it in because Onesimus' name means useful. That's what the name works. So it's a little play on words that if you don't know that, you're like, Paul seems like he's kind of cool, and then he's like a huge jerk in like a couple of these little sections. Yeah, Paul gets that a lot. All right. Last thing, let's look at a map. This is a map of the ancient world. So you can see over here, there's one country you can all spot. I know that. We got the boot, right? There's Italy. And you have this whole area. Now, where we're talking about in here, you can see books like Romans, which is written to the church here in Rome. You have Thessalonians written there. Philippians, there's Philippi. Corinth, Corinthians, right? We're starting to see these are all these letters. These are all the different areas. Where we're talking about is there's Colossae right there. And what's super important is it's right next to Ephesus. Ephesus is the letter to Ephesians, and it's really close to Colossae. Why that matters is that was a key port city in the Roman world. A ton of industry and commerce and things went through there. And this is what we're going to talk next, it was a key port for the slave trade. We're going to talk about the role of slavery because it factors really heavily into this book. Wow, did Jews have slaves? Did Christians have slaves? What did slave owning look like? Was it common? Was it uncommon? All those kinds of things. So Colossae, and this idea that Onesimus was Philemon's slave, would have been incredibly common because it was very close to a key city that was really fundamental in the slave trade. And it was the way that you would have gone through Ephesus in most ways if you were coming by sea to get to Colossae. Any other way would have been too difficult. All right, let's talk about slavery, shall we? Slavery in the ancient world. Slavery became incredibly important and significant. It would have been happening right before the formation of the Roman Empire at large. Because what would happen is every time you would conquer another land or a group of people, you would capture a large section of them and they would become slaves. So one of the facts that we have out there, in one day in the conquering of Gaul, Julius Caesar sold 53,000 men into slavery. There's another estimate that about 10 to 15% of the Roman Empire were slaves. Now, when we talk about slaves, there was a number of different roles, and there's a number of different ways that slavery worked. So you would have people who were captured in warfare. That was the primary way that they generated slaves in slavery. And they would be captured and sold for whatever they were best at. Now, we're talking about human life and the sanctity of human life, so hopefully you'll give me a bit of grace. But one way that's kind of, it can be helpful to think of them, it's not just you had a slave and they went and did hard labor, they did crops or did that. If you think of it more in like the Star Wars world and realm as droids, meaning that you would have people that were specialized in certain things that were then brought in as slaves. So you had people that were highly educated, right? Because these are conquered groups of people that could be interpreters. So they would be bought as a slave that could do interpretation. Or you'd have people that were incredible cooks, or you'd have people that were great at childcare. You'd have people that did all kinds of different skills and things. So this wasn't just a bunch of conquered people that did nothing but grunt labor. They had many, many different roles within the Roman world. Another thing that is significant is a lot of times if you or your family had huge amounts of debt, you could sell someone from your family and they would become a slave, and this would be a way that you would pay off your debt. Now, slaves also did earn money, and there's a way that, depending on the slave owner and depending on the law in that particular area, you could accumulate enough money to buy your own freedom. So freed slaves wasn't something that was uncommon at all. It wasn't very common, but it was something that certainly happened. The other thing that's important to note is that this featured prominently in the church. I already mentioned that slaves had full roles and responsibilities within the church. They weren't seen as another person. And Pope Pius I, because I don't know that we're all Catholic or we understand that, like we know who the Pope is now, but the lineage of the Pope is tracked from Peter, one of the disciples. So there's a whole line that they trace back from Benedict today all the way back to Peter. It's called apostolic succession. And so these popes were the leaders of, at this point, the kind of the known church. Pope Pius I, now we're looking at 140, so we're still within 100 years of Jesus, he was a freed slave. There's actually some story and tradition that even Pope Clement, who would have been in 88, 50 years after Jesus, was also a freed slave. So slavery was something that was fairly common. Now, let's talk about some of the most horrific and barbaric points of slavery. Because slaves, although they had some rights and responsibilities, they were primary property, a number of them would have tattoos on their forehead. And their forehead tattoos would read tax paid, which would mark that they are a slave, or they would even have, if found, please return, written on their forehead. Now, imagine if you were a slave and you purchased your freedom, you couldn't go to untattoo me and have that removed. You would just have that permanently on your forehead for everyone to see. So aware of headbands was something that became common. There's actually a god that they believe was the god of healing in Thessalonica. And they have found in archaeology thousands of tablets that are written by slaves asking the God of healing to heal their forehead tattoos as a way of restoring back to them their humanity. Now, because they were marked in this way, if a slave ran away, this was something that was highly discouraged. If you were found apart from your master, you would be sent back. And it was very common for a slave to be killed. If it was an incredibly valuable slave, they wouldn't be killed, but they would have another tattoo on their forehead of fugitive, would be on their forehead again for the rest of their lives. These were people that were marked and very often killed. Now, to us today, this is unspeakable, that you would have ownership of another human being to do whatever you wanted them to do whenever you wanted them to do it. They didn't have their own life. They didn't have their own freedom. They didn't have any standing within the society. But in this time, it was incredibly common. It was the way that commerce and life happened. And there's all kinds of weird things that we have today that no one's batting an eye at. But someday we will look back and be like, that is all a really odd thing to do. For a lot of our jobs and labor, you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You were commuting over 2 hours a day to go to work? Why would you do that? You were driving a car? Are you not familiar with the public transportation system? Whoa, whoa, whoa. You were eating foods, even though you had plenty of food right here in your own state and area, and you were exporting them from across the world. Why would you do that? You don't even have to go back that far. If you look at pictures of what people were wearing in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you have a lot of questions about us as a culture. We have a way, and every culture does, of creating something incredibly normal that one day we will look back and say, that is far from normal. That is incredibly, incredibly strange. Now, the ownership of human life is not akin to bell bottoms in any way, shape, and or form. But what I'm trying to say is we look at this and say, well, of course this is evil and wrong. And why is Paul even talking to Philemon? He's a slave owner, for heaven's sakes. Because most people were slave owners. Because most people had this understanding that that's just the way things are. So why is this instructive? If you were to read the letter of Philemon and say, you know what? I don't think people should own other people. I would say, okay, that's a real hot take and insight in 2017. But if you said, whoa, 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 there was something that was culturally normative in this time, and the gospel of Jesus Christ had something to say, this is not okay. Even though everybody says it's okay, and everybody's parents and aunts and uncles and friends, they all have slaves, but the gospel says, no, there's another way of seeing humanity that changes this. That is a story that travels. Decades, generations. It has something to say right now to you and me. There's something that we all do that's incredibly normal to us, that if we actually get into Scripture, if we look at the life of Jesus, who he is, Jesus would say, that's real odd. And Christians should be looking into that. Christians should be making movements to change that. Now, does that change overnight? No. Never has, never will. But we start a process of walking a road that brings about the world that is on earth as it is in heaven. This prayer that Jesus taught us, there's this way that Christians should be engaging. We say, there's a way that God has created the world. He's created us relationally. He's created things to work, and we need to be striving and working towards that. The last W I want to look at is the why. The why is this: the gospel must invade all relationships and systems where there are Christians. You are a part of a family. You might have a workplace. You might have a social club or a group that you're a part of. You are currently sitting in a church. You're a part of that. And the gospel of Jesus has something to say about everything that we do. If you're a parent, who you are and how you parent, the gospel has something to say about that. There's a way that we see our children, we see ourselves as parents. If you have a friend, which I hope you do, the gospel has something to say about how you are a friend to someone. If you're a son or a daughter, if you're an uncle or an aunt, the gospel has something to say about how you step into and understand that role. So why are we looking at this context 2,000 years ago at something that has been outlawed and is strictly prohibited in our country? Why are we looking at that today? Because the story of the gospel having something to say about the systems and relationship in that world is the same thing that it has to say about our world. The gospel has something to say. You may not know this, but Christians have a bit of a PR crisis. Most of the time, to most people, when you say, and here's how I know this. Let me take a step back. When I am on a plane and someone says, hey, what do you do? I sometimes want to say, I work for a nonprofit. I'm involved in some measure of social justice. I do talks from time to time, because saying you're a pastor at a church is a sure way to end a conversation. Why? Now, not all the time, not everywhere, but for a number of people, Christians in the church is a four-letter word, and not the good kind. It's something that is bad, and one of the primary reasons why this perception has become more and more a reality is because there's a disconnect between who Christians say they are and who we talk about as Jesus Christ and how we live and engage in the world. There's not alignment in this way. And people have walked away from the institution of the church at a surprising, shocking rate. The church in the United States today is not growing. There's not more people coming to church today than did 10 years ago. Most mainline denominations, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Methodist, they are on rapid decline. I just drove by a church over off Hawthorne. It's vacant. This is a deep historic church that has been there for generations. When you just look at the size and the scope of the building, incredible investment and incredible work of the people was responsible for seeing this thing grow, and it's empty. Why? Because more and more people say, I don't have more trust for people in the church, I have less. I don't experience more love and grace from people in the church, I experience less. I don't experience less judgment from people in the church, I experience more. But you know what else is really interesting? Most people, I would say almost all people, don't have beef with Jesus. If you read about who Jesus was, it's very, very rare that you're like someone like, I just don't trust that Jesus guy. I mean, that's my real issue with the whole thing. People love Jesus. He was amazing. It's his fans that have been the problem. So, what if we took a look again at Jesus and the fact that this message was a revolution, and then we took a nice hard look at our own life, and after we felt really, really bad about all the discrepancies and about all the ways we wanted to go on reality TV and lie, cheat, and steal to make all the money, we extend ourselves the grace that Jesus has already extended us, and we say, okay, let's get about engaging this a step further today. Let's push a little bit more into who Jesus was and who he calls me to be, because here's the secret behind it all. Living the life that Jesus calls us to is freedom. Leaving the life that Jesus called us to is grace. Living the life that Jesus called us to is life in and of itself. Living the life of our culture to get as much as you can, to succeed as much as you can, to be on top of as many people in their stations in life as possible isn't truly life. It's imprisonment. It's death. And so we take seriously the call of Jesus because we trust that this road that on the surface seems more painful, that seems more difficult, is actually where life is found. It's the thing that changes it all. It's the thing that kicks us into gear of who we've been created to be. So here's how I want to end this morning. A time of prayer and a time of silence. Like uncomfortable silence. Are you with me? Like too long, you worried I've fallen asleep silence. Because I think we all have a bit of talking to do with Jesus. And to say, God, maybe you know, right? Maybe you're sitting here and you're like, yep, it's my marriage. Yep, it's my workplace. Yep, it's school where I go. Yep, it's my parenting. Yep, it's my relationship with my parents. Yep, yep, yep. But maybe you're like, I don't know, God, what is it? We're going to have a time of prayer and silence to say, God, where are you calling me to see the gospel, the good news come more and more to bear? And here's the test. How do you know if it's good news? If it's good news for everyone. The gospel of Jesus Christ is good news for everyone. So if you see it being worked out in your life and it's only good news for some, brothers and sisters, it's not good news. It's not good news. So where is God calling the good news for all people to flow in you and through you in the places that you work and live and have relationship? Let's pray. God, I thank you for a letter written nearly 2,000 years ago from a guy named Paul to a guy named Philemon. God, that was dealing with a system that should not have existed. And God, I thank you that letters like that can cause us to look into our own lives and, God, evaluate systems within our own lives that should not exist. God, I pray that your good news that brings forgiveness where there is pain, that brings hope where there is despair, that brings life where there is death, is alive and active and being called into existence today. God, would you call it further to being in our lives? And so, God, would you speak to us now? What's the relationship? What's the system? What's the place, God, where you are inviting us to experience your good news and to bring your good news to bear? God, I pray that you would speak to us in the silence now. God, may you bring us conviction. God, may we receive your grace. And may you give action to our beliefs. It's in your name we pray. Amen. Would you stand up? So may you all go with eyes wide open to see places of slavery within your family, within your workplace, within your relationships. And may you trust the good news of Jesus Christ to bring liberation and freedom to those places. Amen and amen. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.